necessarily attached to her situation that she could, upon the whole, have no cause to repine.
"Obstinate, headstrong girl! I am ashamed of you! Is this your gratitude for my attentions to you last spring? Is nothing due to me on that score? I am not in the habit of being refused!"
"Nor am I in the habit of being intimidated."
"I will not be interrupted! Hear me in silence! My daughter and my nephew are formed for each other. Their fortune on both sides is splendid. They are destined for each other by the voice of every member of their respective houses. And what is to divide them? The upstart pretensions of a young woman whose sister was lately concerned in a scandalous elopement with the son of the elder Darcy's musket polisher? A woman without family, connections, or fortune?"
"Your daughter's fortune is indeed splendid. But pray tell, what other qualities does she possess? Is she fetching? Is she trained in the deadly arts? Has she even strength enough to lift a katana?"
"How dare you! Tell me once for all, are you engaged to him?"
Though Elizabeth would not, for the mere purpose of obliging Lady Catherine, have answered this question, she could not but say, after a moment's deliberation, "I am not." Lady Catherine seemed pleased.
"And will you promise me never to enter into such an engagement?"
"I would sooner die than see my honour so defiled."
"Then, Miss Bennet,"
said Lady Catherine, setting down her parasol and removing her coat,
"die you shall."
Upon this, she set her feet for combat. "Do you mean to challenge me to a duel, your ladyship, here in my family dojo?"
"I mean only to rid the world of an insolent little girl and preserve the dignity of a superior man, lest Pemberley be forever polluted by your stench."
"If that be the case," said Elizabeth, dropping her parasol, "then let this be our first and final battle." Elizabeth set her feet in return. The two ladies, separated by more than 50 years, yet hardly at all in abilities, remained thus for a moment, until Lady Catherine, her plan of attack fully formed, leapt skyward with a strength quite striking for a woman of her advanced age. She flipped through the air over Elizabeth's head and landed a blow on the top of her skull, the force of which brought the younger to her knees. Had Elizabeth been anything less than perfectly fit, the blow would have most assuredly splintered her spine. Lady Catherine landed gently on her feet, and seeing her opponent attempt to rise, sent her flying the length of the dojo with a ruinous kick to the back. Unable to gain her wind, Elizabeth struggled to stand as the aged warrior again approached.
"You have no regard for the honour and credit of my nephew, unfeeling, selfish girl. Do you not consider that a connection with you must disgrace him in the eyes of everybody?" Her ladyship grabbed Elizabeth's gown and lifted her to her feet. "Well, have you anything to say before I remit you to Satan?"
"Just one thing, your ladyship." Lady Catherine's eyes widened as she felt a sharp pain in her belly. She let go and stumbled backward, the handle of Elizabeth's dagger protruding from her gown. The younger took full advantage of this confusion, striking her ladyship about the head, neck, and bosom with a severe combination of blows, and a final kick which drove her so high as to shatter two of the wooden rafters overhead. Outside, Lady Catherine's ninjas turned towards the dojo, alarmed by this tumult. Inside, her ladyship lay motionless on the floor. Elizabeth stood over her, waiting for any sign of life, but none appeared. "Dear Lord," she thought, "what have I done? How shall Darcy ever forgive me for killing his beloved aunt?" The thought was no sooner in her head than Elizabeth felt herself fall to the ground, brought down by Lady Catherine's legs. The latter leapt to her feet, and with a hearty laugh, pulled the dagger from her belly and flung it into Elizabeth's hand, pinning her to the floor.
"It would take skills far exceeding your own to draw but a single bead of exercise moisture from my skin. Weak, silly girl, so long as there is life in this old body, you shall never again be in the company of my nephew."
Lady Catherine's ninjas entered, throwing stars at the ready, but were quickly put at ease by their master, who had the duel well in hand.
"Remain thus, dear ninjas. When I have removed her head, you may do with the body as you please."
As Elizabeth struggled to free herself, her ladyship removed one of the swords from the wall. She unsheathed it and examined its glistening blade.
"Remarkable.
as fine a katana as ever I saw in Kyoto. Pity it should have spent these many years in the charge of so unworthy a family." Lady Catherine looked up from the blade, expecting to see her opponent. Instead, she saw nothing. Nothing but an empty dojo and a pair of broken, lifeless ninjas. She met this, too, with a hearty laugh. "What good fun! I must admit, had you been vanquished with so little effort, I should have been rather disappointed." Lady Catherine walked to the center of the dojo, sword in hand. She turned herself round, expecting an attack, but none came. "Such cowardice!" she cried. "Have you not courage enough to face me? Did your master teach you nothing more than retreat?"
"My master," said Elizabeth, "taught me that the shortest path to ruin was underestimating one's opponent." Her ladyship looked skyward and saw Elizabeth atop a rafter, sword in hand. The younger dove toward the floor as the elder leapt toward the ceiling, and their swords met in the air that separated the two. A ferocious contest of blades filled the dojo with the clanging of steel upon steel. The two women were evenly matched, but Elizabeth's youth bestowed to her the advantage of vigour, and she tired more slowly than her ladyship. After several minutes of flying about, attacking one another with force that would have sent legions of lesser warriors to their graves, Lady Catherine's sword was dispatched with a well-aimed butterfly kick. Defenceless, her ladyship retreated to the wall of weaponry, where she hastily procured a pair of nunchucks, but these were promptly cut in two by Elizabeth's katana. Elizabeth backed Lady Catherine against a wall and held the tip of her sword to her wrinkled throat.
"Well," said Catherine, "take my head then, but be quick about it."
Elizabeth lowered her blade, and with a voice much affected by exercise, said, "To what end, your ladyship? That I might procure the condemnation of a man for whom I care so much? No. No, your ladyship. Whether you shall live to see him married to your daughter or married to me, I know not, but you shall live. And for the rest of your days you shall know that you have been bested by a girl for whom you have no regard, and whose family and master you have insulted in the harshest possible manner. Now, I beg you take your leave." Upon being walked to her carriage, Lady Catherine turned hastily round and added, "My position remains unchanged. I send no compliments to your mother. You deserve no such attention. I am most seriously displeased."
"Her ladyship would be wise to climb into her carriage, lest I change my mind about taking her head." With the deepest disgust, the elder did as she was told. Offering not so much as a slight bow, Elizabeth turned and walked toward the house. She had the carriage drive away as she proceeded upstairs, taking care to conceal her injuries. Her mother impatiently followed her to ask why Lady Catherine would not come in again and rest herself.
"She did not choose it," said her daughter. "She is a very fine-looking woman, and her calling here was prodigiously civil, for she only came, I suppose, to offer her condolences for the passing of Mr. Collins and his wife. She is on her road somewhere, I dare say, and so, passing through Meryton, thought she might as well call on you. I suppose she had nothing particular to say to you, Lizzie."
Elizabeth was forced to give into a little falsehood here, for to acknowledge the truth of what had passed between them was impossible. Chapter 57. The discomfiture of spirits which this extraordinary visit threw Elizabeth into could not be easily overcome, nor could she, after burying the ninjas, learn to think of it less than incessantly. Lady Catherine, it appeared, had actually taken the trouble of this journey from Rosings for the sole purpose of breaking off her supposed engagement with Mr. Darcy. But from what the report of their engagement could originate, Elizabeth was at a loss to imagine, till she recollected that his being the intimate friend of Bingley, and her being the sister of Jane, was enough, at a time when the expectation of one wedding made everybody eager for another, to supply the idea. She had not herself forgotten to feel that the marriage of her sister must bring them more frequently together.
However, she could not help feeling some uneasiness as to the possible consequence of her duel with Lady Catherine. From what she had said of her resolution to prevent their marriage, it occurred to Elizabeth that she would relate the whole of their battle to her nephew, and how he might be swayed by her reasoning and a natural admiration for his aunt. If he had been wavering before as to what he should do, which had often seemed likely, the advice and entreaty of so near a relation might settle every doubt, and determine him at once to be as happy as dignity unblemished could make him. In that case he would return no more. Lady Catherine might see him in her way through town, and the sight of his aunt so freshly bloodied might provoke any number of feelings, not the least of which was resentment for the one who bore responsibility for the injuries. The surprise of the rest of the family on hearing who their visitor had been was very great, but they obligingly satisfied it with the same kind of supposition which had appeased Mrs. Bennet's curiosity, and Elizabeth was spared from much teasing on the subject. The next morning, as she was going downstairs, she was met by her father, who came out of his library with a letter in his hand. "Lizzie," said he, "I was going to look for you. Come into my room." She followed him thither, and her curiosity to know what he had to tell her was heightened by the supposition of its being in some manner connected with the letter he held. It suddenly struck her that it might be from Lady Catherine, and she anticipated with dismay all the consequent explanations. She followed her father to the fireplace, and they both sat down. He then said, "I have received a letter this morning that has astonished me exceedingly. As it principally concerns yourself, you ought to know its contents. I did not know before that I had two daughters on the brink of matrimony. Let me congratulate you on a very important conquest." The colour now rushed into Elizabeth's cheeks, and the instantaneous conviction of its being a letter from the nephew instead of the aunt, and she was undetermined whether most to be pleased that he explained himself at all, or offended that his letter was not rather addressed to herself, when her father continued, "You look conscious. Young ladies have great penetration in such matters as these, but I think I may defy even your sagacity to discover the name of your admirer. This letter is from a Colonel Fitzwilliam, a man who, before receipt of this letter, I had never heard of in all my life." "From Colonel Fitzwilliam? And what can he have to say?" "Something very much to the purpose, of course. He begins with congratulations on Jane's approaching nuptials, of which, it seems, he has been told by some good-natured gentleman. I shall not sport with your impatience by reading what he says on that point. What relates to yourself is as follows. Having thus offered you the sincere congratulations on this happy event, let me now add a short hint on the subject of another, of which I have been advertised by the same authority. Your daughter Elizabeth, it is presumed, will not long bear the name of Bennet after her elder sister has resigned it, and the chosen partner of her fate may be reasonably looked up to as one of the most illustrious personages in this land. Can you possibly guess, Lizzie, who is meant by this? This young gentleman is blessed, in a peculiar way, with everything the heart of mortal can most desire, splendid property, noble kindred, and extensive patronage. Yet in spite of all these temptations, let me warn you of what evils you may incur by a precipitate closure with this gentleman's proposals, which, of course, you will be inclined to take immediate advantage of. Have you any idea, Lizzie, who this gentleman is? But now it comes out. My motive for cautioning you is as follows. We have reason to imagine that his aunt and mine, Lady Catherine de Bourgh, does not look on the match with a friendly eye. Mr. Darcy, you see, is the man. Now, Lizzie, I think I have surprised you. Could he have pitched on any man within the circle of our acquaintance whose name would have given the lie more effectually to what he has related? Mr. Darcy, who never looks at any woman but to see a blemish, and who probably never looked at you in his life. Imagine such a thing! Elizabeth tried to join in her father's pleasantry, but could only force one most reluctant smile. Never had his wit been directed in a manner so little agreeable to her. Are you not surprised? Oh, yes. Pray read on.
After mentioning the likelihood of this marriage to her last night, she immediately expressed what she felt on the occasion when it became apparent that on the score of some family objections on the part of your daughter, she would never give her consent to what she termed so disgraceful a match. I thought it my duty to give the speediest intelligence of this to you, that Elizabeth and her noble admirer may be aware of what they are about, and not run hastily into a marriage which has not been properly sanctioned. The rest of this letter is only about his sorrow upon hearing of Charlotte's beheading and Mr. Collins's suicide. But, Lizzie, you look as if you do not enjoy it. You are not, I hope, pretending to be affronted at an idle report.
Oh, cried Elizabeth, I am excessively amused. But it is so strange.
Yes, that is what makes it amusing. Had they fixed on any other man, it would have been nothing. But his perfect indifference and your pointed dislike make it so delightfully absurd. And pray, Lizzie, what said Lady Catherine about this report? Did she call to refuse her consent? To this question his daughter replied only with a laugh, as it had been asked without the least suspicion. Elizabeth had never been more at a loss to make her feelings appear what they were not. It was necessary to laugh when she would rather have cried. Her father had most cruelly mortified her by what he said of Mr. Darcy's indifference, and she could do nothing but wonder at such a want of perception, or fear that perhaps, instead of his seeing too little, she might have fancied too much.
Chapter 58. To Elizabeth's great surprise, Mr. Bingley brought Darcy with him to Longbourn before many days had passed after Lady Catherine's visit. The gentleman arrived early, and before Mrs. Bennet had time to tell him of their having seen his aunt, of which her daughter sat in momentary dread, Bingley, who wanted to be alone with Jane, proposed their all walking out. It was agreed to. Mrs. Bennet was not in the habit of walking. Mary could never spare time, but the remaining five set off together. Bingley and Jane, however, soon allowed the others to outstrip them. They lagged behind, while Elizabeth, Kitty, and Darcy were to entertain each other. Very little was said by either. Kitty was too much afraid of him to talk. Elizabeth was secretly forming a desperate resolution, and perhaps he might be doing the same. They walked towards the Lucases, because Kitty wished to call upon Maria, and as Elizabeth saw no occasion for joining her, when Kitty left them, she went boldly on with him alone. Now was the moment for her resolution to be executed, and while her courage was high, she immediately said, "Mr. Darcy, I am a very selfish creature, and for the sake of giving relief to my own feelings, care not how much I may be wounding yours. I can no longer help thanking you for your unexampled kindness to my poor sister. Ever since I have known it, I have been most anxious to acknowledge to you how gratefully I feel it. Were it known to the rest of my family, I should not have merely my own gratitude to express."
"I am sorry, exceedingly sorry," replied Darcy in a tone of surprise and emotion, "that you have ever been informed of what may, in a mistaken light, have given you uneasiness. I did not think Mrs. Gardiner was so little to be trusted."
"You must not blame my aunt. Lydia's carelessness first betrayed to me that you had been concerned in the matter, and of course I could not rest till I knew the particulars. Let me thank you again and again, in the name of all my family, for that generous compassion which induced you to take so much trouble, and offer to kneel before you now and administer the 7 cuts that you might be honoured by trampling my blood."
"If you will thank me," he replied, "let it be for yourself alone. That the wish of giving happiness to you might add force to the other inducements which led me on, I shall not attempt to deny. But your family owe me nothing. Much as I respect them, I believe I thought only of you." Elizabeth was too much embarrassed to say a word. After a short pause, her companion added, "You are too generous to trifle with me. If your feelings are still what they were last April, tell me so at once. My affections and wishes are unchanged, but one word from you will silence me on this subject forever." Elizabeth now forced herself to speak, and immediately, though not very fluently, gave him to understand that her sentiments had undergone so material a change since the period to which he alluded as to make her receive with gratitude and pleasure his present assurances.
The happiness which this reply produced was such as he had probably never felt before, and he expressed himself on the occasion as sensibly and as warmly as a man violently in love can be supposed to do. Had Elizabeth been able to encounter his eye, she might have seen how well the expression of heartfelt delight diffused over his face became him. But though she could not look, she could listen, and he told her of feelings which, in proving of what importance she was to him, made his affection every moment more valuable. They walked on without knowing in what direction. There was too much to be thought and felt and said for attention to any other objects. She soon learnt that they were indebted for their present good understanding to the efforts of his aunt, who did call on him in her return through London, and there relate her journey to Longbourn, its motive, and the substance of her duel with Elizabeth, dwelling emphatically on the latter's failure to kill her when she had the chance, in the belief that such a show of weakness would forever turn Darcy's eye away. But unluckily for her ladyship, its effect had been exactly contrariwise. "It taught me to hope," said he, "as I had scarcely ever allowed myself to hope before. I knew enough of your disposition to be certain that had you been absolutely, irrevocably decided against me, you would have beheaded Lady Catherine without a moment's hesitation." Elizabeth coloured and laughed as she replied, "Yes, you know enough of my temper to believe me capable of that. After abusing you so abominably to your face, I could have no scruple in beheading any number of your relations. What did you say of me that I did not deserve? For though your accusations were ill-founded, formed on mistaken premises, my behaviour to you at the time had merited the severest reproof. It was unpardonable. I cannot think of it without abhorrence." "We will not quarrel for the greater share of blame annexed to that evening," said Elizabeth. "The conduct of neither, if strictly examined, will be irreproachable. But since then we have both, I hope, improved in civility." "I cannot be so easily reconciled to myself. The recollection of what I then said, of my conduct, my manners, my expressions during the whole of it, is now, and has been many months, inexpressibly painful to me. Your reproof, so well applied, I shall never forget. Had you behaved in a more gentlemanlike manner, those were your words. You know not, you can scarcely conceive, how they have tortured me, though it was some time, I confess, before I was reasonable enough to allow their justice. I was certainly very far from expecting them to make so strong an impression. I had not the smallest idea of their being ever felt in such a way." Darcy mentioned his letter. "Did it make you think better of me?" She explained what its effect on her had been, and how gradually all her former prejudices had been removed. "I knew," said he, "that what I wrote must give you pain, but it was necessary. I hope you have destroyed the letter." "There was one part especially, the opening of it, which I should dread your having the power of reading again. I can remember some expressions which might justly make you hate me." "Think no more of the letter. The feelings of the person who wrote, and the person who received it, are now so widely different from what they were then, that every unpleasant circumstance attending it ought to be forgotten. You must learn some of my philosophy. Think only of the past as its remembrance gives you pleasure." "With me it is not so. Painful recollections will intrude which cannot, which ought not, to be repelled. I have been a selfish being all my life, in practice, though not in principle. As a child I was taught what was right, but I was not taught to correct my temper. I was given the best training, but left to use it in pride and conceit. Unfortunately, an only son, for many years an only child, I was spoilt by my parents, who, though good themselves, my father particularly all that was benevolent and amiable, allowed, encouraged, almost taught me to be selfish and overbearing, to care for nothing beyond the defence of my estate, to think meanly of all the rest of the world. Such I was, from 8 to 28, and such I might still have been but for you, dearest, loveliest Elizabeth. What do I not owe you? You taught me a lesson, hard indeed at first, but most advantageous. By you I was properly humbled. I came to you without a doubt of my reception. You showed me how insufficient were all my pretensions to please a woman worthy of being pleased. After walking several miles in a leisurely manner, and too busy to know anything about it, they found at last, on examining the precise position of the sun, that it was time to be at home. What could become of Mr. Bingley and Jane? Was a wonder which introduced the discussion of their affairs. Darcy was delighted with their engagement. His friend had given him the earliest information of it. "I must ask whether you were surprised," said Elizabeth. "Not at all. When I went away, I felt that it would soon happen." "That is to say, you had given your permission?" "I guessed as much." And though he exclaimed at the term, she found that it had been pretty much the case. "On the evening before my going to London," said he, "I made a confession to him, which I believe I ought to have made long ago. I told him of all that had occurred to make my former interference in his affairs absurd and impertinent. His surprise was great. He had never had the slightest suspicion. I told him, moreover, that I believed myself mistaken in supposing, as I had done, that your sister was indifferent to him, and as I could easily perceive that his attachment to her was unabated, I felt no doubt of their happiness together. Elizabeth could not help smiling at his easy manner of directing his friend. "Did you speak from your own observation," said she, "when you told him that my sister loved him, or merely from my information last spring?" "From the former. I had narrowly observed her during the two visits which I had lately made here, and I was convinced of her affection."
"And your assurance of it, I suppose, carried immediate conviction to him?"
"It did. Bingley is most unaffectedly modest. His timidity had prevented his depending on his own judgment in so anxious a case, but his reliance on mine made everything easy. I was obliged to confess one thing which, for a time, and not unjustly, offended him. I could not allow myself to conceal that your sister had been in town 3 months last winter, that I had known it, and purposely kept it from him. He was angry, but his anger, I am persuaded, lasted no longer than he remained in any doubt of your sister's sentiments. He has heartily forgiven me now." As they made for the house, Elizabeth and Darcy happened upon a herd of unmentionables, no more than a dozen in number, which had quartered itself in a garden not 10 yards from the road. The creatures were crawling on their hands and knees, biting into ripe heads of cauliflower, which they had mistaken for stray brains. Elizabeth and Darcy laughed at the sight, and for a moment resolved to keep walking, as the zombies had failed to take notice of them. But sharing a glance and a smile, the pair realized they had stumbled onto their first opportunity to fight side by side. And so they did. Chapter 59.
"My dear Lizzie, where can you have been walking to?"
was a question which Elizabeth received from Jane as soon as she entered their room, and from all the others when they sat down to table. She had only to say in reply that they had wandered about till she was beyond her own knowledge. She coloured as she spoke, but neither that nor anything else awakened a suspicion of the truth. The evening passed quietly. The acknowledged lovers talked and laughed, the unacknowledged were silent. Darcy was not of a disposition in which happiness overflows in mirth, and Elizabeth, agitated and confused, anticipated what would be felt in the family when her situation became known. At night she opened her heart to Jane, though suspicion was very far from Jane's general habits, she was absolutely incredulous here.
"You are joking, Lizzie. This cannot be. Engaged to Mr. Darcy? No, no, you shall not deceive me. I know it to be impossible. This is a wretched beginning indeed. My sole dependence was on you, and I am sure nobody else will believe me if you do not. Yet indeed I am in earnest. I speak nothing but the truth. He still loves me, and we are engaged."
Jane looked at her doubtingly.
"Oh, Lizzie, it cannot be. I know how much you dislike him."
"You know nothing of the matter. That is all to be forgot. Perhaps I did not always love him so well as I do now, but in such cases as these, a good memory is unpardonable.
This is the last time I shall ever remember it myself. Jane still looked all amazement. Elizabeth again, and more seriously, assured her of its truth.
Good heaven! Can it really be so?
Yet now I must believe you, cried Jane.
My dear, dear Lizzie, I do congratulate you, but are you certain, forgive the question, are you quite certain that you can be happy with him?
There can be no doubt of that. It is settled between us already that we are to be the happiest couple in the world. But are you pleased, Jane? Shall you like to have such a brother?
Very, very much. Nothing could give either Bingley or myself more delight. But we considered it, we talked of it as impossible. And do you really love him quite well enough? Oh, Lizzie, do anything rather than marry without affection. Are you quite sure that you feel what you ought to do?
Oh, yes. You will only think I feel more than I ought to do when I tell you all.
What do you mean?
Why, I must confess that I love him better than our games of kiss me, dear.
I am afraid you will be angry.
My dearest sister, now be serious. I want to talk very seriously. Let me know everything that I am to know without delay. Will you tell me how long you have loved him?
It has been coming on so gradually that I hardly know when it began, but I believe I must date it from my first seeing the way his trousers clung to those most English parts.
Another entreaty that she would be serious, however, produced the desired effect, and she soon satisfied Jane by her solemn assurances of attachment. When convinced on that article, Miss Bennet had nothing further to wish.
"Now I am quite happy," said she, "for you will be as happy as myself. I always had a value for him. Were it for nothing but his love of you, I must always have esteemed him. But now, as Bingley's friend and your husband, there can be only Bingley and yourself more dear to me. But, Lizzie, you have been very sly, very reserved with me. How little did you tell me of what passed at Pemberley and Lambton?"
Elizabeth told her the motives of her secrecy, but now she would no longer conceal from her Darcy's share in Lydia's marriage. All was acknowledged, and half the night spent in conversation.
"Good gracious,"
cried Mrs. Bennet, as she stood at the window the next morning, "if that disagreeable Mr. Darcy is not coming here again with our dear Bingley, what can he mean by being so tiresome as to be always coming here? I had no notion but he would go a shooting or something or other, and not disturb us with his company. What shall we do with him? Lizzie, you must walk out with him again, that he may not be in Bingley's way." Elizabeth could hardly help laughing at so convenient a proposal, yet she was really vexed that her mother should be always giving him such an epithet. As soon as they entered, Bingley looked at her so expressively and shook hands with such warmth as left no doubt of his good information, and he soon afterwards said aloud, "Mrs. Bennet, have you no more lanes hereabouts in which Lizzie may lose her way again today?"
"I advise Mr. Darcy and Lizzie and Kitty," said Mrs. Bennet, "to walk to the burning grounds of Oakham Mount this morning. It is a nice long walk, and Mr. Darcy has never seen the flames."
"It may do very well for the others," replied Mr. Bingley, "but I am sure it will be too much for Kitty. Won't it, Kitty?" Kitty owned that she had rather stay at home. Darcy professed a great curiosity to see the flames of the mount, and Elizabeth silently consented. As she went upstairs to get ready, Mrs. Bennet followed her, saying, "I am quite sorry, Lizzie, that you should be forced to have that disagreeable man all to yourself, but I hope you will not mind it. It is all for Jane's sake, you know, and there is no occasion for talking to him except just now and then. So do not put yourself to inconvenience."
During their walk, it was resolved that Mr. Bennet's consent should be asked in the course of the evening. Elizabeth reserved to herself the application for her mother's. She could not determine how her mother would take it, sometimes doubting whether all his wealth and grandeur would be enough to overcome her abhorrence of the man. In the evening, soon after Mr. Bennet withdrew to the library, she saw Mr. Darcy rise also and follow him, and her agitation on seeing it was extreme. She did not fear her father's opposition, but he was going to be made unhappy, and that it should be through her means, that she, his best warrior, should be distressing him by her choice, should be filling him with fears and regrets in disposing of her, was a wretched reflection, and she sat in misery till Mr. Darcy appeared again, when, looking at him, she was a little relieved by his smile. In a few minutes he approached the table where she was sitting with Kitty, and while pretending to admire her work, said in a whisper, "Go to your father. He wants you in the library." She was gone directly. Her father was walking about the room, looking grave and anxious. "Lizzie," said he, "what are you doing? Are you out of your senses to be accepting this man? Have you not always hated him?" How earnestly did she then wish her former opinions had been more reasonable, her expressions more moderate. It would have spared her from explanations and professions which it was exceedingly awkward to give, but they were now necessary, and she assured him with some confusion of her attachment to Mr. Darcy. "He is rich, to be sure, and you may have more fine clothes and fine carriages than Jane, but will they make you happy?" "Have you any other objection," said Elizabeth, "than your belief of my indifference, or the loss of my sword?" "None at all. We all know him to be a proud, unpleasant sort of man, and Longbourn, indeed, all of Hertfordshire would be the worse for losing you. But this would be nothing if you really liked him."
"I do. I do like him," she replied with tears in her eyes. "I love him. Indeed, he has no improper pride. He is perfectly amiable. You do not know what he really is. Then pray do not pain me by speaking of him in such terms."
"Lizzie," said her father, "I have given him my consent. He is the kind of man, indeed, to whom I should never dare refuse anything which he condescended to ask. I now give it to you, if you are resolved on having him. But let me advise you to think better of it. I know your disposition, Lizzie. I know that you could be neither happy nor respectable unless you truly esteemed your husband, unless you looked up to him as a superior. Your extraordinary skill in the deadly arts would place you in the greatest danger in an unequal marriage. You could scarcely escape discredit and misery. My child, let me not have the grief of seeing you unable to respect your partner in life."
Elizabeth, still more affected, was earnest and solemn in her reply, and at length, by repeated assurances that Mr. Darcy was really the object of her choice, by explaining the gradual change which her estimation of him had undergone, relating her absolute certainty that his affection was not the work of a day, but had stood the test of many months' suspense, and enumerating with energy all his good qualities, she did conquer her father's incredulity and reconcile him to the match.
"Well, my dear," said he, when she ceased speaking, "I have no more to say. If this be the case, he deserves you. I could not have parted with you, my Lizzie, to any one less worthy." To complete the favourable impression, she then told him what Mr. Darcy had voluntarily done for Lydia. He heard her with astonishment. "This is an evening of wonders, indeed." And so Darcy did everything. Gave the money, paid the fellow's debts, and rendered him lame? So much the better. It will save me a world of trouble and economy. Had it been your uncle's doing, I must and would have paid him. But these violent young lovers carry everything their own way. I shall offer to pay him tomorrow. He will rant and storm about his love for you, and there will be an end of the matter. He then recollected her embarrassment a few days before on his reading Colonel Fitzwilliam's letter, and after laughing at her some time, allowed her at last to go, saying as she quitted the room, "If any young men come for Mary or Kitty, send them in, for I am quite at leisure." Elizabeth's mind was now relieved from a very heavy weight, and after half an hour's meditation in her own room, she was able to join the others with tolerable composure. Everything was too recent for gaiety, but the evening passed tranquilly away. There was no longer anything material to be dreaded, and the comfort of ease and familiarity would come in time. When her mother went up to her dressing-room at night, she followed her and made the important communication. Its effect was most extraordinary, for on first hearing it, Mrs. Bennet sat quite still and unable to utter a syllable.
Nor was it under many, many minutes that she could comprehend what she heard. She began at length to recover, to fidget about in her chair, get up, sit down again, wonder, and bless herself.
"Good gracious! Lord bless me! Only think, dear me! Mr. Darcy! Who would have thought it? And is it really true? Oh, my sweetest Lizzie, how rich and how great you will be! What pin money, what jewels, what carriages you will have! Jane's is nothing to it, nothing at all! I am so pleased, so happy! Such a charming man, so handsome, so tall! Oh, my dear Lizzie, pray apologize for my having disliked him so much before. I hope he will overlook it. Dear, dear Lizzie, a house in town, everything that is charming, 3 daughters married, 10,000 a year, and very likely more. 'Tis as good as a lord, and a special license. You must and shall be married by a special license. But, my dearest love, tell me what dish Mr. Darcy is particularly fond of, that I may have it tomorrow.
This was a sad omen of what her mother's behaviour to the gentleman himself might be, and Elizabeth found that, though in certain possession of his warmest affection and secure of her relations' consent, there was still much to be wished for. Peace in England, the approbation of Mr. Darcy's relatives, and a mother with whom she had anything whatsoever in common. But the morrow passed off much better than she expected, for Mrs. Bennet luckily stood in such awe of her intended son-in-law that she ventured not to speak to him unless it was in her power to offer him more tea or wipe crumbs from his trousers. Elizabeth had the satisfaction of seeing her father taking pains to get acquainted with him, and Mr. Bennet soon assured her that he was rising every hour in his esteem. "I admire all my 3 sons-in-law highly," said he. "The Wickham," he said with a sly smile, "is perhaps my favourite, for he fidgets the least."
Chapter 60 Elizabeth's spirits soon rising to playfulness again, she wanted Mr. Darcy to account for his falling in love with her. "How could you begin?" said she. "I can comprehend your going on charmingly when you had once made a beginning, but what could set you off in the first place? I cannot fix on the hour, or the spot, or the look, or the words which laid the foundation. It is too long ago. I was in the middle before I knew that I had begun. It could not have been my beauty or my killing skills, for they are each quite equal to your own. As for my manners, my behaviour to you was at least always bordering on the uncivil, and I never spoke to you without wishing to give you pain. Now be sincere. Did you admire me for my impertinence?"
"For the liveliness of your mind, I did."
"You may as well call it impertinence. It was very little else. The fact is that you were sick of civility, of deference, of officious attention. You were disgusted with the women who were always speaking and looking and thinking for your approbation alone. I roused and interested you because I was so unlike them. I knew the joy of standing over a vanquished foe, of painting my face and arms with their blood yet warm, and screaming to the heavens, begging, nay, daring God to send me more enemies to kill. The gentle ladies who so assiduously courted you knew nothing of this joy, and therefore could never offer you true happiness. There, I have saved you the trouble of accounting for it, and really, all things considered, I begin to think it perfectly reasonable. To be sure, you knew no actual good of me, but nobody thinks of that when they fall in love. Was there no good in your affectionate behaviour to Jane while she was ill at Netherfield? Dearest Jane, who could have done less for her? But make a virtue of it by all means. My good qualities are under your protection, and you are to exaggerate them as much as possible. And in return, it belongs to me to find occasions for teasing and quarrelling with you as often as may be, and I shall begin directly by asking you what made you so unwilling to come to the point at last. What made you so shy of me when you first called and afterwards dined here? Why, especially when you called, did you look as if you did not care about me?"
"Because you were grave and silent, and gave me no encouragement."
"But I was embarrassed."
"And so was I. You might have talked to me more when you came to dinner." "A man who had felt less might." How unlucky that you should have a reasonable answer to give, and that I should be so reasonable as to admit it. But I wonder how long you would have gone on if you had been left to yourself. I wonder when you would have spoken if I had not asked you.
Lady Catherine's unjustifiable endeavour to separate us and your head from its perch were the means of removing all my doubts. Your refusal to finish her had given me hope, and I was determined at once to know everything.
Lady Catherine has been of infinite use, which ought to make her happy, for she loves to be of use. But tell me, what did you come down to Netherfield for? Was it merely to ride to Longbourn and be embarrassed, or had you intended any more serious consequence?
My real purpose was to see you, and to judge, if I could, whether I might ever hope to make you love me. My avowed one, or what I avowed to myself, was to see whether Jane was still partial to Bingley, and if she were, to make the confession to him which I have since made.
Shall you ever have courage to announce to Lady Catherine what is to befall her?
Like you, I am not wanting courage, but I am wanting time, and if you will give me a sheet of paper, it shall be done directly.
And if I had not a letter to write myself, I might sit by you and admire the evenness of your writing, as another young lady once did. But I have an aunt, too, who must not be longer neglected. From an unwillingness to confess how her prospects with Mr. Darcy had been overrated, Elizabeth had never answered Mrs. Gardiner's long letter. But now, having news which she knew would be most welcome, she was almost ashamed to find that her uncle and aunt had already lost 3 days of happiness, and immediately wrote as follows. "I would have thanked you before, my dear aunt, as I ought to have done, for your long, kind, satisfactory detail of particulars. But to say the truth, I was too cross to write. You supposed more than really existed. But now, suppose as much as you choose, give a loose rein to your fancy, indulge your imagination in every possible flight which the subject will afford, and unless you believe me actually married, you cannot greatly err. You must write again very soon, and praise him a great deal more than you did in your last. I thank you again and again for not going to the lakes. How could I be so silly as to wish it? Your idea of the phaeton and zombies is delightful. We will go round the park every day, whipping them till their limbs fall off. I am the happiest creature in the world. Perhaps other people have said so before, but not one with such justice. I am happier even than Jane. She only smiles. I laugh. Mr. Darcy sends you all the love in the world that he can spare from me. You are all to come to Pemberley at Christmas. Yours, etc. The joy which Miss Darcy expressed on receiving similar information was as sincere as her brother's in sending it. 4 sides of paper were insufficient to contain all her delight and all her earnest desire of being loved and trained by her sister. Chapter 61. Happy for all her maternal feelings was the day on which Mrs. Bennet got rid of her 2 most deserving daughters. With what delighted pride she afterwards visited the new Mrs. Bingley and talked of the new Mrs. Darcy may be guessed. I wish I could say, for the sake of her family, that the accomplishment of seeing so many of her children happily settled made her a sensible, amiable, well-informed woman for the rest of her life, though perhaps it was lucky for her husband, who took such pleasure in teasing her, that she still was occasionally nervous and invariably silly. Mr. Bennet missed his 2nd daughter exceedingly. His affection for her drew him oftener from home than anything else could do. He delighted in going to Pemberley, especially when he was least expected. As Mr. Bennet had predicted, Hertfordshire also longed for the company of its 2 fiercest protectors. In the days and months preceding, with only 2 of the younger Bennet sisters to ward them off, the zombies descended in ever greater numbers, until Colonel Foster returned with the militia and set the burning grounds afire once more. Mr. Bingley and Jane remained at Netherfield only a 12-month. Jane could not bear to be so close to Longbourn as a married woman, for every unmentionable attack made her long for her sword. The darling wish of Mr. Bingley's sisters was then gratified. He bought an estate in a neighbouring county to Derbyshire, and Jane and Elizabeth, in addition to every other source of happiness, were within 30 miles of each other. Determined that they should keep their skills sharp, though His Majesty no longer required them to do so, their husbands built them a sparring cottage precisely between the two estates, in which the sisters met joyously and often. Kitty, to her very material advantage, spent the chief of her time with her two elder sisters. In society so superior to what she had generally known, her improvement was great. She was not of so ungovernable a temper as Lydia, and removed from the influence of Lydia's example, she became, by proper attention and management, less irritable, less ignorant, and less insipid. When she announced that she should like to return to Shaolin for 2 or 3 years in hopes of becoming as fine a warrior as Elizabeth, Mr. Darcy was only too happy to pay for the whole. Mary was the only daughter who remained at home, both by the necessity of there being at least one warrior to protect Hertfordshire, and Mrs. Bennet's being quite unable to sit alone. As she was no longer mortified by comparisons between her sister's beauty and her own, Mary began to mix more with the world, eventually taking up rather intimate, infrequent friendships with several soldiers of the returned militia. As for Wickham and Lydia, their characters suffered no revolution from the marriage of her sisters. In spite of everything, they were not wholly without hope that Darcy might yet be prevailed on to make Wickham's fortune. The congratulatory letter which Elizabeth received from Lydia on her marriage explained to her that, by his wife at least, if not by himself, such a hope was cherished. The letter was to this effect.
"My dear Lizzie, I wish you joy. If you love Mr. Darcy half as well as I do, my dear lame Wickham, you must be very happy. It is a great comfort to have you so rich, and when you have nothing else to do, I hope you will think of us. I am sure Wickham would like a parsonage very much when he is finished at seminary, and I do not think we shall have quite enough money to live upon without some help. Any parsonage would do, of about 300 or 400 a year. But, however, do not speak to Mr. Darcy about it, if you would rather not. I must be off, as my beloved has soiled himself anew. Yours, etc.
Elizabeth endeavoured in her answer to put an end to every entreaty and expectation of the kind. Such relief, however, as it was in her power to afford, in the form of fresh linens and salted beef, she frequently sent them. It had always been evident to her that such an income as theirs, under the direction of two persons so extravagant in their wants and heedless of their future, must be very insufficient to their support. And whenever Wickham's studies required the purchase of a new hymnal for the lame, or lectern for the lame, or altar for the lame, either Jane or herself was sure of being applied to for some little assistance towards discharging their bills. Though Darcy could never receive him at Pemberley, for Elizabeth's sake he assisted him further in his profession. Lydia was occasionally a visitor there, when her husband was gone to minister in the asylums of London, and with the Bingleys they both of them frequently stayed so long that even Bingley's good humour was overcome, and he proceeded so far as to talk of giving them a hint to be gone. Miss Bingley was very deeply mortified by Darcy's marriage, but as she thought it advisable to retain the right of visiting at Pemberley, she dropped all her resentment, was fonder than ever of Georgiana, almost as attentive to Darcy as heretofore, and paid off every arrear of civility to Elizabeth. Pemberley was now Georgiana's home, and the attachment of the sisters was exactly what Darcy had hoped to see. They were able to love each other even as well as they intended. Georgiana had the highest opinion in the world of Elizabeth, though at first she often listened with astonishment bordering on alarm at her lively, sportive manner of talking to her brother, and cringed at her tales of ripping the beating hearts from the chests of untold enemies. Through Elizabeth's instructions, Miss Darcy became a finer warrior than she ever dared hope. For beyond improving her musketry and bladesmanship, she also began to comprehend that a woman may take liberties with her husband, which a brother will not always allow in a sister more than 10 years younger than himself. Lady Catherine was extremely indignant on the marriage of her nephew,
and her reply to the letter which announced its arrangement came not in written form, but in the form of an attack on Pemberley by 5 and 10 of her ladyship's ninjas. For some time after this was thwarted, all intercourse was at an end. But at length, by Elizabeth's persuasion, he was prevailed on to seek a reconciliation, and after a little further resistance on the part of his aunt, her resentment gave way, either to her affection for him, or her curiosity to see how his wife conducted herself, and she condescended to wait on them at Pemberley, in spite of that pollution which its woods had received, not merely from the presence of such a mistress, but the visits of her uncle and aunt, with whom Darcy and Elizabeth were always on the most intimate terms. Like so many before it, her ladyship's serum proved folly, for while it slowed some effects of the strange plague, it was helpless to stop them all. England remained in the shadow of Satan. The dead continued to claw their way through crypt and coffin alike, feasting on British brains. Victories were celebrated, defeats lamented, and the sisters Bennet, servants of His Majesty, protectors of Hertfordshire, beholders of the secrets of Shaolin, and brides of death, were now, three of them, brides of man. Their swords quieted by that only force more powerful than any warrior. The end. Afterward. For some fans of Jane Austen, the mere existence of Pride and Prejudice and zombies is a travesty. Why would anyone add gratuitous scenes of violence, carnage, and cannibalism to one of the greatest novels of Western civilization? Somewhere in the nave of Winchester Cathedral, we imagine that Austen's corpse, though presumably dead, must be rolling. Or perhaps not. It's hard to speculate what Austen might think of Pride and Prejudice and zombies, because zombies themselves didn't become popular in literature until the 20th century. Even Victor Frankenstein's monster, a proto-zombie with no taste for brains, didn't make his appearance until the year after Austen's death in 1817. But we do know what Austen thought of the tales of terror that flourished during her lifetime. In her early novel, Northanger Abbey, Austen has fun mocking the remote castles, mysterious groans, and murderous tyrants who filled the pages of 18th-century Gothic romances. The work's foolish heroine, Catherine Morland, can't get enough of Anne Radcliffe's best-selling The Mysteries of Udolpho, and she is thrilled to learn that her friend Isabella Thorpe has made out a list of 10 or 12 more novels of the same kind.
"Have you indeed? How glad I am! What are they all? I will read you their names directly. Here they are, in my pocket-book. Castle of Wolfenbach, Claremont, Mysterious Warnings, Necromancer of the Black Forest, Midnight Bell, Orphan of the Rhine, and Horrid Mysteries. Those will last us some time." "Yes, pretty well. But are they all horrid? Are you sure they are all horrid?" "Yes, quite sure. For a particular friend of mine, a Miss Andrews, a sweet girl, one of the sweetest creatures in the world, has read every one of them."
The books on Isabella's reading list have no shortage of horrid subject matter, including abductions, murders, usurpations, black magic, mysterious cults, sexual transgressions, and all manner of unexplained noises and shadowy figures. Many are also horridly written. With Northanger Abbey, Austen critiques late 18th-century readers for their indiscriminate consumption of any work whose title bears the word castle or mystery. She has good reason to do so. Between the 1780s and 1820s, as many as 5,000 Gothic works were churned out of the presses. Most of these novels were panned by critics for being immoral, formulaic, sensational, and improbable. For every decent novel, like The Mysteries of Udolpho, there were scores of inferior imitations, works hastily created to feed the reading public's insatiable desire for all things Gothic. Other mysterious titles published in Austen's day include
The mysterious count, the mysterious seal, the mysterious visit, love, mystery and misery, Swedish mysteries, or the hero of the mines, the mysterious freebooter, Italian mysteries, or more secrets than one, mystery, a novel, the mysterious penitent, the mysterious hand, or subterranean horrors, the mysterious wife, the mysterious husband, and the provocatively titled The Mysterious Pregnancy. We must assume that the title Northanger Abbey is a nod to other terrifying tales from the 1790s that were set in abbeys. Munster Abbey, Grassville Abbey, Children of the Abbey of Cluny, Netley Abbey, Waldeck Abbey, the Abbey of St. Asaph,